Hello, this is Down the Back of the Seats. I'm Ellen, cinema manager at Campbelltown Picture House.
And I'm Alistair, a film and theatre maker based on the Isle of Mull.
Alistair, what is this podcast about?
This podcast explores what happens when public spaces and the public meet. What's left behind? What's been found that's unexpected? What stories are there to tell? It's tales from behind the scenes at the cinema, theatre, concert hall, wherever people meet, linger, and leave things or bits.
Do you want to know what film at the moment has double chance of having bits in it?
Oh, is it? Well, we've had Paddington in Peru, haven't we? So I'm guessing Dogman?
Dogman is very bit heavy. I was thinking of, actually, The Brutalist, because it has.
Really?
Because it has.
Well, it's got bits on screen.
Has it?
Yeah. Adrian Bobie's in it.
Does he get his bits out?
Yep.
That's why it's an 18. I was wondering why it's an 18.
Yep.
Oh. I was going to watch it the other day, but I watched Better Man again instead. I wasn't really feeling up for The Brutalist.
I'm really curious about it. Yeah, so why is The Brutalist bits heavy, apart from the obvious bit ratio on screen?
Well, it could be bit heavy, because it has an interval.
Now, does it say interval or does it say intermission on the screen? I wonder which is it.
All right, it says intermission, but I'm...
Does it?
Yeah, it does say intermission, but I'm steadfastly calling it an interval. It's American, isn't it?
I guess that's what it is, yeah. I mean, obviously, it's a matter of pride that 2001 has an intermission. That goes without saying. But interval, intermission, interval!
Is it an American versus British, or is it a film versus theatre? Do films have intervals?
I'm not sure.
Does theatre have intermissions?
I would say theatre has an interval.
I would as well. But in other countries, in those other countries...
I guess interval can be the space between things as well, whereas an intermission is a break between the two things, rather than the space between. So in the intermission, I was intervalling. Instead of interrailing. I've been over to Denmark, I've been intervalling.
We need to find an American and ask them whether they have an intermission in a theatre play.
Hmm.
Or a Canadian. I'll ask a Canadian. Anyway...
Brutalist. I'm curious to kind of know about it, because I must be honest, the length of it put me off. I had a chance to see it in Edinburgh, but didn't go for it because I was working the next day and I needed to be quite focused. But I was talking to someone last night, I was teaching actually, and there was a teacher in the Highlands that I was working with who said they'd gone to see it, I think, in Eden Court. And... she said it was like watching Godfather Part 1 and Part 2 in one go. It was like, it felt that special as well. It's like, oh my goodness, that's really fantastic.
Every single person that's come out of it who's watched it here, we just started it this week, so we're a little bit behind when it was actually released. But every person that's come out has said it's absolutely wonderful, and you need that time. You need the whole thing in order for it to develop. We've had a few people, it surprised us, we've had a few people who've not realised how long it is. Because we all sort of make a little joke when people come in and go, oh, are you in for the long one? Are you in for the long haul? And there's a few people who have looked blankly at us. And then we've said, you do realise how long you're in here for. And they've then had to phone husbands or wives at home to say, I'm going to put the dinner back in the oven, I'm going to be late. Yeah. So as I say, everyone has thought it's wonderful.
Oh, that's so good to hear. So there's a very interesting thing that's gone around this, the side of the culture of cinema, is that the director has not made a single penny out of it yet, apparently.
Which,
because he... So it's like 3 years it's taken to make the film. And he said the last paycheck he had was 3 years ago. And that is because he was using commercial work, directing TV shows for Netflix and things like that, to then... pay for his time to allow him to develop this movie. So obviously the producer looks for kind of funding to pay the actors and all sorts of different bits and bobs. But in terms of the director's own salary, he seems to have gone into it as a passion project to say, no, I'll do this for free. And that's the thing that so many of us have. Like, if you are, I've not toured a film around international film festivals, and I've not been in that situation, but it's very rare that the films I've been made have been paid properly. And it's difficult. It's a very difficult thing when it's passion projects, and it's a really tricky thing, because, you know, are you an amateur? Are you not? Well, that's a really very difficult discussion. Amateur means lover of, which is great, but yeah, really interesting. I hope that he makes money out of it eventually. He should do in the long run with like distribution deals on streamers and physical, if there's any physical media left at all. He should get something, and then other people will want him to come in and do things for them. So hopefully it's one that will pay off in the long term.
Yeah, I feel sorry for him because of the AI controversy, and I'm putting controversy in inverted commas because...
Oh yes, that's right, the tuning of the voice.
From what I understand, it's not a controversy at all, or it shouldn't be a controversy at all. He used AI to help with the Hungarian language and refining some of the dialogue, and for creating some of the architecture, some of the shots of the architecture, he used AI, which is exactly the same way that you'd use CGI or any other sort of film technique ever. And it's just a shame that AI at this point has become a bit of a buzzword for bad or lack of creativity and has been applied to his film.
I think that's getting mostly forgotten, though, because the weight of the success of the film is so... It's got so much momentum. Another thing with, like, touring films as well is, you know, you're not paid very often to go to film festivals. If you are headlining or something like that, there's a good chance you might get something. But mostly you're not. You're there to exhibit your film, which is a market. But it's essentially, film festivals are marketplaces. And so you're there representing your product. So when you've got a small independent film, such as many people I know have, you can end up, if it's successful, touring for bloody ages with this film, and, you know, staying in nice hotels for free and eating mostly free food, but actually not making any income, and you'll be trying to make your next one or set your next film up, writing in cafes, writing in your hotel room, and it's a really difficult balance, and you know, I'm 46 now, and it's like, this is what grown-ups do. So, but we're very lucky with our setup. But yeah, it's really tricky. It's a really difficult one. And I also, sorry if I'm ranting.
Ranting? What?
That should be down the back of the seats bingo. Sorry if I'm ranting. Ellen says, it's fine. Or Alistair cries or says, sorry if I'm ranting. But the notion of the artist is really pissing me off at the moment as well, because artistry is a key thing. But actually, I think the level... creating something that's truly popular that connects with people is much harder than being an artist saying, no, this is my vision. And I think that's really, really important. So I've got an increasing... I've always loved popular culture, but I've got an increasing respect for popular culture that has heart and soul to it. Having experienced working with an artist recently who, supposedly as a filmmaker, didn't understand a single concept of continuity editing. A single one. Like, just was completely, completely oblivious to it. And yet is supposed to be this great, successful person. And it's like... oh dear, this is ego.
it always just comes back to Paddington 2 being the greatest film that's ever been made.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, that's where it is. Artistically perfect and connects with its audience, with all audiences that could possibly watch it.
With heart and soul, yeah. It's got kindness at the core of it as well. And I think where there's ego, there's not much kindness. Mm. So, I'm having a debate in my head over the last few months about what is artistry as well, because someone I used to know, who I no longer have anything to do with, because they're a cunt, sorry, let's not have that in there. Well, maybe. I don't know. I think that's the...
It's staying.
Oh, damn it. Sorry, Mum. It's not my mum, but this person... is now pretending at being an artist in the most kind of extraordinary of ways. And, you know, because they're pretending to be an artist, they are an artist. That's the way it works. And they're from quite a wealthy background. And they are presenting themselves as a working class artist, as part of a working class network of people. And it's like, you're not working class. That is ridiculous. And it's just this vanity and ego of the artist and this, the tragedy of the narrative of the self. I just find it's too much. I just want to make nice things that make people connect with other people and have a laugh and, or, you know, explore ideas. And yeah.
It's a common thing for actors as well to say that they were discovered in some sort of random happenstance way. You hear it on lots of actors interviewed on podcasts that I listen to, and they'll always, American actors usually, will always say something like, I didn't even know that you could be an actor for a living. You know, I grew up in Hollywood, but I never even knew that you could be an actor. And then all of a sudden I was just discovered. I went with my friend to an audition and I thought, I may as well audition while you're here. And you're thinking, no, there's not a chance that you went through school and somebody didn't say, oh, you're quite good at this, or you didn't realize that you're quite good at this. There's a very lovely, very good actor and doing very well for himself. He's a known actor who grew up in Chipping Norton, where I used to work at the cinema, and went through the Chipping Norton Youth Theatre, which is a very good, very, very good youth theatre. It used to be run by a woman called Jo Higgins, who was absolutely superb and enhanced the lives of many an angst-ridden teenager. And he went through youth theatre and he was always brilliant, and it was always obvious that if he wanted to do it, then he would be able to do it. And she nurtured him and she helped him and she encouraged him. And in interviews, he has been told to say by his publicist that he just fell into it. You know, he went along to an audition with a friend and then he thought he may as well audition, and he's been told to say these things because that's the narrative that people want.
That's really awful, because that takes away the democracy of the process. That, you know, youth theatres don't necessarily cost a lot, and youth theatres very often have means to allow kids to take part for much, you know, for nothing or very little. And it's open access stuff very often, and that's so important. Yeah. So that is the system trying to keep it locked into the push and the people that are, yeah, make it seem inaccessible. That's...
I know. Well, his story is not the best thing that Jo did in the youth theatre. She gave confidence and an outlet and a safe space for hundreds of young people. Yeah. Jo Higgins, she is great.
We're very lucky here on Mull. We've got Andy Stevens, who used to be with Ballet Rombert back in the early days of her career. And then... was on West End stage. She was in Godspell, I think, with David Essex, who she said was a bit a Tory. She said she's a total Tory. And then she also worked with Geese Theatre, who do work with offenders in prisons in Cumbria when she was living in Cumbria. And she works with our local youth theatre here and has done generations of young people work. And she's just brilliant. And my son is going to be doing St. Crispin's Day speech from Henry V. And so I'm going to film that tonight for the film rehearsal, and then they open on Friday night. So yeah, she's great, absolutely fantastic, and these people make such a difference. They really do. It's really, really important.
We've got an email. Do you want to talk? Should we go to the email now? It's not about sexxx. Mysterious nemesis caller that wanted us to do that. It is about independent cinemas.
Oh, cool.
So this is from Beth, and she says, hello, Alan and Alistair. And then she writes some nice things about us, which I won't say, but I'll tell you about them later. My question, I'm delighted to see Edinburgh Film House is being saved. Likewise, so are we. How can you tell what is truly an independent cinema? Picture House gives the impression that it's an indie, but I think they're owned by Cineworld, which is correct.
The Picture House chain, yeah.
Yeah, not Campbelltown Picture House, which is independent. And in brackets, she says, and treated their staff terribly during the pandemic. Her words, not mine. Are there any umbrella organisations that support independent cinemas like SAU?
The Scottish Artists Union.
Yes.
Which is a fantastic thing if you're a freelance artist working within all across Scottish mediums. I'm not a member, but I use their pay scale, which is very, very reasonable, very fair. Over to you, Ellen. You know this landscape much better than I.
Well, sort of. So it is difficult to tell from the outside. And Picture House, the chain, they... I like to give the impression, I guess. I mean, it's no secret that they are part of a chain themselves and then have been bought by Cineworld. So they were a chain before they were bought by Cineworld.
And were they a successful kind of trading operation as a, like a five or six kind of, yeah, was it a strong unit?
Yes, yeah. Each site is distinct. And when I used to work there, they had a marketing manager for each site who was in charge of doing sort of independent-y cinema things. So yes, they do like to give that impression. How can you tell what is a truly independent cinema? I mean, you can dig around and look at their finances and go on to Companies House and see what they are, if that's something that you care about.
Their constitution, yeah.
Their constitution, ask the people that work there, I guess. There's...
What are the independent cinemas in Scotland? We've got
CBH, we've got GFT,
Dunoon, and
Greenock.
The Greenock together as that's a unit itself. They're independent.
Yeah. Eden Court. Is that run by the council?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so yeah, Eden Court.
There's the one in Armadale. What do you call it? The beautiful one in Armadale. That's older, just older than CBH, where the...
How dare you? Nobody's older.
Hippodrome.
Yeah. Hippodrome. They are run right, but they're run by the council, though. They are run by Falkirk Council. They are still an independent cinema, and the people that work there are wonderful and lovely people. I think it's a little bit dangerous to think of independent cinemas as good and chain cinemas as bad. Because that's not the case. There are wonderful people.
We all love cinema.
The people that work there and the people that manage them tend to be...
Scream Machine's an independent cinema.
Yes, Scream Machine.
Scream Scotland, yeah.
Yeah, oh, there's loads of them. And then there's loads of them. The Robert Burns.
In Dumfries, that's right.
There's one in Orkney, which is council... Yeah.
That's a big one, actually. It's quite a lovely space, that.
Is it?
I've worked there briefly. I was working with school children up there. We showed the last of the Spider-Man movies. The middle of the Spider-Man movies, most recent trilogy. It was wonderful. It was, I loved it. It does feel like a council building, though. It feels quite sort of rectangular inside. And I was completely compelled. And the staff were fantastic, really. People who just cared. It was lovely.
Yeah. How can you tell? How can you tell? I don't know.
They smell different.
I smell. Do I? What? There's a very stressed manager trying to keep their independent cinema's head above water. I think that's how you tell. Look into the eyes of the manager.
Yeah, if you can see tears when they're talking to you, you know that you're independent. Beth asks as well, obviously, about the umbrella organisations then. So, yes. Yeah, what are the support organisations for independent cinemas?
The one that I came across when working for Picture House was BEC2, which is a technical union, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Parallel to Equity, yeah. Mostly technical folk and theatre and cinema will be part of something like BEC2, yeah, other than Equity, yeah. And then the kind of the noisier talents would be
with Equity.
Yeah.
Umbrella organisations, there is the UK Cinema Association. You have to join, and there's a fee to join, but it's an incredibly small fee. considering the incredible work. I love the UK Cinema Association so much. Phil Clapp is the managing director, head guy, CEO, I don't know what he's called, but absolutely brilliant. And they look after the, they also have chains as well. So it's the UK Cinema Association in total. So they look after all the cinemas in the UK, any cinema who joins, which is, the money is well worth it. They deal with any government legislation. They sort of, they look at anything that's coming down that could affect us and put it into easy to understand language and give advice. And you can ask them anything and they will help out. They're absolutely brilliant. So I think as far as supporting independent cinemas, the UK Cinema Association does.
BFI Film Hubs as well.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, support, there's different sort of different levels of support. So the UK Cinema Association support us operationally, and then things like the BFI Hub and Screen Scotland and provide support for cinemas financially in terms of funding that you have to apply for. And
BFI Film Hubs are quite interesting, though, as well, because they come up with deals for films and things as well,
yes,
don't they? And seasons, yeah. And that's kind of another means of support for the independent, well, for all of cinema, really.
Yeah, there's loads. And then for the likes of me, there's a sort of informal network that you build up around your pals. So I've got a couple of people who run cinemas in Scotland who I will message and say things like, was Andre Rieu really loud last night? Did you have to turn it down? And they go, oh, yeah, yeah. And there's sort of Facebook groups and WhatsApp. Sorry, I did mention Andre Rieu and I was just pulling his gun into.
Yes.
Yeah, in sort of informal. And, oh, did you have a really shitty time with this film? Yes. And so informal support networks. But I think the answer to her question is the UK Cinema Association.
That's great. Thank you, Beth. That was a really good question.
Yes.
And thanks for listening, and hopefully see you, hear from you again.
Right. What have you been watching this week?
We watched a film from the 1970s with Steve Guttenberg, so you know it's a good one, called The Boys from Brazil. And this is a film that I saw when I was a kind of late teenager, early 20s. And my son's really interested in the Second World War, so we thought we'd watch this film about Hitler's clones. Hitler's clones and Steve Guttenberg. There you go.
Something factual for Cole to get. Yes,
it's a documentary. No. It's Gregory Peck and James Mason. And there's a really, really... And Laurence Olivier. And there's a really, really good film in there, but it's just... It doesn't keep up with where we're at with our attention spans these days, because it's okay. I mean, there's some good stuff in there, but as my wife Georgia said, it's waiting to be remade in many ways, and I think there is something to be found in a remake of it that would be very good. It's a brilliant idea for a story of, it might have been a novel beforehand, I think, actually, but Gregory Peck as a plays Joseph Mengele, the most awful kind of concentration camp scientist and doctor who experimented on people in the most terrible of ways. And at the end of the war, he's managed to get a piece of Hitler's rib and some of his flesh, and is using this to clone him. And then each of the clones is, well, I don't want to spoil it, but it's got to be the similar situation to what Hitler grew up in. And so they're trying to make them by both biological and sociological means, and it's a really good idea, but it's just a bit chuch for nowadays. It's kind of dry, and but I've been listening to a friend's podcast, which is a fantastic, called Writers on Film by John Bleasdale, and there are two episodes which I've caught recently, which just I thought were superb. The first of which was with David Thompson, who wrote the Biographical Dictionary of Cinema, which, if you don't have a copy, is superb. It's a really great book. We have it in the toilet because it's a really good one to dip in and out of. It's good. And they talk about the experience of watching movies and understanding movies, and oh, it's absolutely superb. It's really provoked me into thinking about, actually, so where, what is the position that we watch movies from? And I think
sitting. I'm normally sitting.
You're not on your exercise bike. Where mentally do we locate ourselves when we watch films? And they kind of identify in their conversation, yeah, there's this sort of comfort buffer of the first few years of films that we watch, and maybe into our late teenage years, that provide us with a series of points of view that we like and we find comfortable, and we know, because, you know, we like The Hunt for Red October or whatever dinosaurs is missing, and that means comfort, that means good. So other films which then represent aspects of those films are what please us or not. And I thought that's really, really interesting. So that was one episode with that. Another episode was with the amazing Jeff Dyer, who wrote Zona, which, oh, I've got it sitting beside my bed. I'm not reading it very fast. I've got it sort of, I'm reading it a little bit. It's about Stalker, the Tarkovsky movie, children's favourite. It's a very, very long movie. Basically, he just retells the structure of Stalker from kind of his personal point of view. And it's an amazing book. But I've also got his fantastic book, Broadsword Calling Danny Boy, which is about Where Eagles Dare. So Jeff Dyer's episode with Mr. Bleasdale, John Bleasdale, is fantastic as well. Really worth checking out. So that's what I've been listening to that's been good. How about yourself? Have you watched? Have you listened to anything interesting? Go.
It was a little while ago, but I watched a film that you recommended that I watched, Flow.
I loved Flow. Oh, thank goodness. So it wasn't just fine, you loved it. Good.
I mean, it was fine, obviously.
What? Well, stop it.
Yes, I like
so good.
It's so good. So Flow is a film about, it's an animated film, and it follows a little cat, little black cat, whose world is destroyed somehow. You don't really know why. There's a big flood. You're not really sure why, but it is something to do with humans. But you never see any humans. You see a digger destroying the forest at one point, but you never see it. And this cat and some other animals, a capybara? Is that what?
A capybara, yeah.
Yeah.
A dog.
And a dog. Oh, the dog. And a secretary bird. They sort of survive for an hour and a quarter, and then that's the end of the film, and it's lovely. Do you know what? I thought I was going to enjoy it. I loved it, but I'm not sure how much I enjoyed it, because mm-hmm. the cat was in peril. The cat's fine, right? I'm going to spoil everything. Everything's fine.
The cat
fine.
Doesn't die in it.
The
yeah.
cat is fine. The dog is fine. The secretary bird is fine. And the capybara is fine.
Yeah.
So don't worry about watching it. Don't worry
for the
that
characters.
Anything as bad as it is again. But it was in peril so much. And the little cat was doing expressions like Lyra does when, that's my cat, when she's upset about something, and it was making noises that, when the cat was sort of trying to hunt something, it was doing the little back, which is what Lyra does.
Wonderful.
So I was getting all upset that the cat was in peril. So I don't know if I enjoyed it, and I don't know if I'd watch it again, because it was just.
But no, it's really good. I mean, it's really, really good. Visually, the visual storytelling in it is fantastic. It really uses the fact there's no words to tell the story in visually interesting ways. The way the water rises, and you can see the scale and speed at which the water's rising, is so compelling and absolutely terrifying by just essentially a close-up. You'd normally think you'd show something like that in an establishing shot or really wide shot. Nope. They just show it in kind of essentially a close-up of just the water level rising up something that's really, really high and really fast. And you're like, oh my God, it's so powerful. And there's also, it's got moments of mysticism in it that which were unanticipated that are so beautiful. I thought it was great. I really, and also, like, it's not our world. And so there's aspects of the society that we see that are really stunning. And I liked it a lot. Technically, there's so much to love in it. And the fact that it was made with Blender, which is free software, is just awesome. The fact is that it's a Latvian movie, and to see a Latvian movie on the world stage like this is, you know, so cool. And also, I've got, when I got to see it, I got my own screener of it, and it had my name burned into it as a watermark. So anytime there was a black screen, it would say Alistair Satchel, and it was like, oh, thank you.
I watched it as part of the ICO screening days, which is another great organisation that looks after independent cinemas, or works for independent cinemas, is the Independent Cinema Organisation.
Yeah,
that's who they are. I definitely should have mentioned them earlier. Anyway, they do these screening days, and you can either go in person or you can do them online. So, and Flow was one of the films. The first film that I watched. I find animation is very personal, but my uncle, Roger Mainwood, was an animator and a brilliant animator. And when we watched good animated films, then he would email me and tell me about them, or I'd email him and tell him about them. And he died. So I couldn't watch animated films for a good couple of years because I would just get sad that I couldn't.
Yeah.
Couldn't Which email I, him and tell them about him.
Yeah.
And so Flow, I found it quite mixed emotion because I thought, Uncle Roger would have loved this. He would have watched this and been able to tell me all the things that I've missed about it. So I still find animated films, even though I love animated films, I still find them a little bit difficult.
That shows you how personal film is. That, you know, it's. I always say when I'm teaching film, film is part of us, and that's why it matters so much, and that's why it's such a culturally significant medium. Is we embrace it in a way that we don't tend to do with other things like books. Yeah, we do, and plays are a little bit more abstract, but films we just really, because we can watch them at any time. We draw them inside of us, and they become part of our DNA. And it's really interesting watching my son watching films that I love. Brazil is one of my favourite films, and I said to him I really like it, but he's now like, Brazil, just totally kind of like, yeah, that's his world, terrifyingly. Film matters. That's why.
Yeah.
I think let's call it a day there.
Yeah, that's a perfect moment. Film matters. That's the conclusion.
Yeah, genuinely it does.
No, it does. I'm sorry, I'm being a little facetious because I find most films fine, but it does.
Film is fine.
Film's fine. So,
what's your favourite loch in Scotland, by the way?
Oh, so it took me a minute. It's fine.
Oyster. Oh, sorry,
terrible. That's a little. Argyll and Bute joke for everyone.
It's not for fans of Scottish fjords, there's a little joke.
Right, go away. If you would like to get in touch with us, please do, about anything that we've talked about or anything else. We're on downthebackoftheseats@gmail.com, or you can contact us on the various socials media, except X, of course, @downthebackoftheseats.
Thanks for listening. See you again.